Years ago, almost 26 now, I made my first journey to Ananda in Nevada City, up in the Sierra Nevada foothills. And I remember going to my first Sunday service just like this. It was in the old dome, which has since fallen down. Having been brought up in the Catholic tradition, I had known Jesus. I had known God the Father. I had known the Holy Spirit. But I never heard those names like Yukteswar and Lahiri. And when they said the invocation of the prayer, I thought, who are these people? And I was so relieved when somebody said, Jesus Christ. I said, oh, they're in good company. And over the years since that first experience of the great gurus of our path, I have come to appreciate more and more what this reading was all about those great realized souls, the souls who are one with God and who voluntarily choose not to live in eternity, in eternal bliss, but to come back on the human plane to help us achieve our destiny, the same destiny. And they play this out in a broad way. Master tells the story that during World War II, he whispered in Hitler's ear and suggested that he open up the front in the Pacific. And against all the advice of his generals who felt that to divide his power would be certain defeat, Hitler proceeded. And they lost. And Master shortened the war. Of course, he didn't stop all the evil in the world. It's such a mystery. All this karma, these interweavings of our lives as we play them out, hopefully ever more in attunement with our own divine purpose. And also in that same time period, I remember Padre Pio coming into the awareness of the American people. Swami says that he thinks Padre Pio was self-realized. And there was this group of American bombers, pilots, who were going up on a mission over Italy. And they saw in the sky on their way this huge, gigantic figure of a monk, arms outstretched in blessing. And they completed their mission, and most came back, if not all. And they were puzzled by this, thinking that only each one of them had seen it, until one ventured to say, did you, by the way, did you see that? And then they discovered that they had all seen it. And at the time, Padre Pio was just a monk, a Cistercian monk, living up in obscurity in this monastery in southern Italy. But he was self-realized. He was a stigmatist. He would say Mass and become so devotionally involved with the consecration of the host and the idea of the crucifixion and death of Jesus and the resurrection that it would take what normally would be 45 minutes or an hour, it would take 3 hours. And people in that church with him would be lifted on waves of exaltation by the very nature of being in his presence. And then there are the stories. I love this. As a Catholic, you know, you go to confession. And Pio would spend hours in the confessional, sometimes 14 hours, hearing the pilgrims and the people from the village, hearing their confessions. And every now and then, as you were waiting outside, you'd hear these great exclamations of anger because somebody hadn't given the complete list of sins, and he was filling it out for them. And he took a sincere personal interest in every soul that came before him. And I feel a particular connection with Padre Pio because when I was in my early 20s, I went through a kind of spiritual crisis. And at the time, I thought that I was going to devote my life to being a nun in a monastery. But it wasn't working out. I just didn't feel happy there, but I didn't know what God wanted from me. And so I was inspired to write Padre Pio a letter. And he answered. And he didn't solve my problem. Oh, no. At least not then. He merely said, through his secretary, he said, I will pray for you. And you pray too. I came across that letter not too long ago. And I realized that while it took years for that promise of his to play out, it played out in a variety of ways that ended up with me at Ananda. After all, Padre Pio was the one to whom a devotee of this path came and said, you know, Padre, I am a Kriyaban. And Pio said, shh, that's good, but don't tell anybody. As an enlightened master, he wasn't conscripted by the dogma, by the narrowness of institutional religion. He had the ability to leap over those walls, and he did. But he dealt with everybody. Now, it's personally comforting to me to know that the masters are in charge. Because if we were in charge, who knows what would happen. But especially in this particular time, when it's so easy to fall into the sensibility of fear and despair and anxiety and stress, you just have to read the morning paper. The whole world is under stress, economically, politically, spiritually. And yet we know that Babaji has committed himself to stay in this world, to oversee the evolution of this age as it morphs into the new age, a higher age, and that he is helping all of the realized masters to complete their mission. He's in communication with Jesus. He's in communication with Master. And there's a wonderful little story. I told it last summer, but I think I'll tell it again, that describes exactly how intimate the involvement of these great masters in our lives. Last summer, it was about Spiritual Renewal Week, and I had plans to go, but I was only going to go the day it started. And a week before, a very tragic accident had happened at Ananda. The son of a good friend of mine, the principal at the high school there, was killed. And that day, before I arrived, they had the funeral. Gary went up, his brother Ananta were there, and they were leading the funeral, friends of the family. And the next day, I came. Everybody was talking about that funeral. And they were describing it to me. Oh, Helen, they said, the feeling of upliftment. It was so sad, but it was so uplifting. I felt wafted away on waves of joy. And even my friend, the mother of this boy, said to me, Helen, I was in a state of grace the entire time. Even though Johnny was gone, I just felt the presence of the masters. And later on that day, I went, as is my custom, to the Taylor household, where I usually stay when I visit. And the daughter, Tammy, was there, and whom I've known all her life since she was 4 years old. And her little daughter, Anjali, was there, who is now 4 years old, or was at the time. And they told me the story, that during the funeral, the mother and the little girl were sitting right up front, but to the side in the amphitheater overlooking Lotus Lake. And as things were going on, the children were very quiet. They were very good. The other little boy was there too. And suddenly, Anjali is her name, said, Mama, Mama, God is right in front of me. And her mother said, shh. And she said, Mama, God is right in front of me, and there's someone with him. And her mother said, oh, what's God doing? And she said, he's giving love to everybody. And her mother said, now, we've got to be quiet. But later on, after all was over, there were about 500 people at this service. And they weren't all Ananda people. They were friends of Johnny. They came in their black leather outfits with their tattoos. But there was, even from everybody, that great sense of something uplifting and special. So later on, her mother revisited the conversation with Anjali. And she said, well, what did God look like? And she instantly said, he looked like Papa John, her grandfather. He said he was old and he was big. And her mother said, well, what did the other person look like? Well, he looked like you, Mama. He had long, dark hair and he was young, just like you. And they got the picture of Johnny, the boy who died, out. And they said, is this who it was? No, no. And so her grandmother took her into the meditation room and said, do you see him here? And she went right up to the picture of Babaji and she said, this is he. So Babaji and Master, in the consciousness of the four-year-old, were visible. And in the consciousness of those of us who have had enough time to build those walls and to have those experiences which make us take little steps back from that purity of heart and which we're trying to regain, but it was there. He was there, and everybody said it, and it was palpable, and it was uplifting, and it was joyful, and it was just a funeral of one single individual. But they're there. Now, to me, that's extremely comforting. But the other side of this story is our part in it. They were there because of the receptivity of the devotees and the friends who were at that moment hearts wide open. And that's for us to see too. Master says, Swami says, that the first thing, the most important thing we can do is to develop our devotion, because it is then that the masters can come in and take charge of our lives, as we say in the purification ceremony. And how to develop that devotion? Well, through the affirmation, through the sharing, through meditation, through prayer, through satsang, through the service, through every little thing that we do. And the cumulative effect when we come together is incredible. I experienced it last week, for I went back to the very place that I started, the meditation retreat. And this time I was accompanied by the Living Wisdom School Middle School. Every year, this is our eighth year, and every year we go for a retreat. And the children, they're 12, 13, 14 years old, love that field trip. You know, we do other things. We go canoe camping, and we go backpacking, and we go to Yosemite, and we go to Ashland and Washington, D.C., and all these. And when it came down to it, if we had to choose which field trip to cut, which would it be? Not the meditation retreat, they said. Oh, no. And we were actually surprised. Sometimes we underestimate our own power as a group of devotees to deliver the goods. But we do. And there they were in the meditation retreat, and they did all the things that young children do. They fooled around. But we also did math, and we did language arts, and we did vocabulary. And they went out and they did hikes to Bald Mountain. They found a mountain lion print, and they discovered bear scat, and they found a teepee, and they yelled and screamed and disturbed all the people who were trying to be quiet. But they also had breakfast in silence and sadhana in the Babaji cave. And you know, when all was said and done, those children, when they had a choice, went back to the Babaji cave, unsupervised, unscripted, and we only found out afterwards. And what did you do in the Babaji cave? We played the little gong, we meditated, we felt the vibration. And when you ask them, what do you like about the meditation retreat? They don't know what to say. It is inexpressible. Because what they're experiencing is vibration, the vibration of all of the hands that make the miracle. We ran into Satya. Satya is now 82 years old. Satya is white-haired and a little wizened, and he walks through the door with a spring in his step. And I remember Satya. I spent my first Christmas Eve there with Satya. But these children don't know who he is, and he has this light in his eyes. And Satya was there the first winter of the meditation retreat's existence. And he used to tell the story of how Swami would go off during those months and give talks and classes to make the money to pay the mortgage, and then those few hardy souls would stay back. And then they had very little money, very little food, very little shelter. It was cold, and they stayed there. And there's Satya, 82 years old. They'll never know the hands that converted the old root cellar for the old dining room into the Babaji cave. But they were loving hands. And those people still are probably not even at Ananda, some of them. Some of them are off in other places, centers, and other communities. They'll never know. The people here, whose faces I see in front of me, who came last Sunday at this almost this very time to celebrate the blessing of the new school building that these children use. They won't know you, but they are the recipients of the power that you have given them by sharing your very being, all your love, all your service, all your prayers. I can't tell you how uplifting it was last Sunday as you threw the rose petals on the building and chanted the song. How uplifting it was to feel your support as we who work in the school day by day. You know, it's not always a picnic. But to feel that support, it was so beautiful. And that, of course, is the trick. How do we keep our minds and hearts open to feel those moments, those hints, those whispers of eternity that will guide us onward in our journey? Last week, the week before last week, I was in the community and I was walking from my apartment to the dining hall, which is not a very long distance. And I passed another devotee, we said hi. And I just felt in that moment this wisp of joy that just came up spontaneously through my awareness, through my being, in my step, in my whole body. And I thought to myself, Helen, remember this. Remember this moment and all the moments like it that can string together until there's nothing in between. So for all of us, as we go through the humdrum of our daily moments, let us look for those wisps of joy that come our way and that will ultimately send us over into the eternal bliss.